History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Well, James, we're going to talk about the Battle of the Somme. Would you like me to read a description of what it was like before the battle? All right, here we go. So this is what British historian Brian Gardner says, that the region is, and this is before the outbreak of the war in 1914, the River Somme was a minor placid waterway of northern France. It meandered gently through Picardy. Men fished on its banks, levers nestled in the reeds, and punts slipped in and out of its complicated channels. On the uplands to either side, villages lay in the folds of undulating slopes. It was a countryside of singular rural beauty, not unlike parts of Hampshire. Oh, sounds nice. The Somme watered it all, the fat orchards, the rich cornfields, the marshy meadows. Life was a matter of sowing, reaping, and gathering the harvest, of apple picking, of children's laughter, of fish hiding near the banks, of the sound of church bells drifting over the valley on still Sunday mornings. Sounds a lot like the Shire. Pretty nice, huh?
Yeah, I had the exact same thought, Scott. But a couple of Tolkien nerds here. I was thinking the Shire as well.
Well, you're probably also thinking what happens next. Saruman is about to visit, along with the Rufians,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, so the nine riders from Mordor.
So in this episode, listeners, you probably know this is part of our key battles of World War One, and this is Key Battle 7, the Battle of the Somme. Things are not going to be very picturesque for very long. And
it's going to get really ugly really quick.
Yeah, let's just show you a glimpse of Eden before the snake enters and the fall happens. I suppose we should start with the beginning. And the war is going on as it has been. And what's the background to this battle that we should know about?
Yeah, so we're in 1916 still. And as I mentioned a few episodes ago, 1916 is often called by historians the year of battles. Not because there were no battles in any of the other years, there were, but because in 1916, we had four massive battles, all of which, they were basically at the same time. They didn't all last as long as others, but we talked a while back about the Battle of Verdun, which was the earliest of the four massive battles to start. It started in February of 1916 and lasted until December. So that's a 10-month long battle. 299 days. I couldn't remember that number last time we talked, Scott. But
56-day wars.
Exactly. 100 Gettysburgs almost. But Verdun was, our listeners may recall, was an attack that the Germans did on the ancient and very important to the French site of Verdun, which was a fortress city. And it looked like it was going to work for a while. They pushed the French back. They captured a lot of key forts near Verdun, but eventually the German attack ran out of steam and the French pushed them back. The French were desperate for something to take some pressure off of them. They needed somebody to hit the Germans somewhere else so that the Germans couldn't focus all their attention on Verdun, you know, distract them, give them other places where they have to send troops. So the Russians attacked, had a major offensive in the east, of course, and that was led by a general called Brusilov, and so it was called the Brusilov Offensive, and that was a massive, massive battle with hundreds of thousands of casualties, and both the German army, as well as the Austrians, as well as the Russians, all of them took a major hit. They were all bled very much. I don't want to say bled dry, but pretty close. And then the third major battle that we talked about in 1916 was Jutland. It didn't really affect what was going on in the land that much, but it was the largest sea battle in world history with hundreds of ships when you combine the two sides. It was a tactical win on the part of the Germans because they inflicted more damage on the British than the British did on them, but it was a strategic loss for Germany because the British Navy was going to keep the German Navy bottled up for the rest of the war, with the exception of submarines, of course. So now we're coming to the fourth key battle of that year, the fourth major battle. And of course, that is the Battle of the Somme. And this was an attempt by the British, and the French were supposed to be involved in it. But as we're going to see, they're going to end up not being able to get too heavily involved. And it's got to be mainly Britain versus Germany. But this was an attempt by General Douglas Haig to relieve pressure on the French and also to capture as many guns and other German military equipment as possible. He thought it was going to be a great victory. You know, everybody always thinks that, right, Scott? Nobody ever says, hey, we're about to have a major loss and we're going to lose hundreds of thousands of people. Isn't that great?
I can't wait to dig in for 3 or 4 months and watch our supply lines run dry. That'll be bold and glorious, and people will make murals of it.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be great. In fact, it's going to be so great. Well, going back to what Haig actually said, Haig said it's going to, we're going to smash the Germans. We're going to march into Germany. We're going to end the war with this massive attack. And so he brought in film crews. I find this fascinating. They actually brought in crews to film what was going to be this great British breakthrough victory. And so you had people filming the battle. And what's really interesting about this, I learned, Scott, was that later a patriotic British film was made called The Battle of the Somme, and they worked in some of this footage, but they also put in fake stuff, like like actors playing soldiers and, you know, trying to make it look better than it really was, trying to convince the British people that it really was a brilliant British victory. And as I was preparing over the last few days for this episode, of course, I did the research and wrote the notes several months ago, but I wanted to kind of refresh my memory. And so I was watching some documentaries that I got off of Amazon Prime. And I was watching this one called The Battle of the Somme, The True Story. And I thought it was going to be about the battle, but it was actually about the movie. Huh. And they talked about, and it was really interesting. These guys we're trying to find out what parts of the movie really happened, were like real actual battle footage, and what parts were staged. I highly recommend that. It was just really fascinating. It was about an hour long or so. Very interesting stuff. And this footage from the Battle of the Somme, you see it in pretty much every World War I documentary. There's a famous shot of a man carrying another soldier toward a medical aid station, carrying him through the trench. There's another classic scene of these guys walking across some high ground from far away, and you see a lot of them actually falling because they were shot. So I highly recommend that, listeners, if you get a chance, Amazon Prime, The Battle of the Somme, The True Story. It's about the movie. But anyway, so we've got a film crew, so we got to win, right, Scott? We can't lose this one.
You know, this is another thing that starts in World War I but is perfected in World War II, of using film as a propaganda, and where reality and cheerleading, where it begins or ends, the line is very blurred.
Absolutely. And the British were masters of propaganda, at least in the First World War. Now, Allied high commanders thought that a massive coordinated attack along a wide front might break the Germans, as I've already hinted. It would also keep the Germans from shifting forces from one front to the other. The plan was to overrun the German front line at the Somme, then pause, then take the second line, and then the open country beyond. That's the dream of every World War commander, right, Scott? We're really going to break through. You know, we're going to break through this static trench-based system, and we're going to just march as far as we want. We'll see how that works out. The problem with this plan, well, there were several problems, but the main problem was that by this time, the Germans had developed an incredibly complex and very well-fortified system of trenches. So we're not talking just like a hole in the ground or, you know, some kind of Civil War trench. No, no, no. We're talking about an elaborate network with concrete, bunkers, and all kinds of stuff. The British plan was to fire nearly 1,500 artillery pieces. That's not shells. That's pieces. That's guns. 1,500 guns. And they would extensively use their air force prior to the attack. The British Air Service was now equal in strength to its German counterpart. And 19 British and 3 French divisions would participate in the attack, and the British overall commander on the ground would be Sir Henry Rawlinson. So Sir Douglas Haig is the overall commander of the British Expeditionary Force, but the actual commander at the Somme is going to be Rawlinson. All right, you ready to launch the attack, Scott?
Let's do it. Let's jump right in.
All right. And by the way, I should mention that this attack was originally planned for much later, but they'd been planning this for a long time. The British and French high command started planning this offensive late 1915, but what it was going to be, I don't remember exactly when it was supposed to start, but it was going to be much later than July like maybe August, September. But after Verdun got sprung on the French begged the British, please move it up, make it earlier. So they did. So the first British barrage began on June 24th. They fired 1.7 million shells. 1.7 million. That's just staggering to think of. And you would think, how could anything be alive after that? How could anything not be destroyed? But there were two major problems. One, many of the shells were duds, and they just went up in the air and landed and went thump, and that was it. No explosion. Many others just churned up the earth. They also had the wrong kind of shell. Oh, I'll talk more about this a little bit later. But so that was the plan. 1.7 million shells fired on June 24th to soften up the German lines and hopefully cut the barbed wire, things like that. The infantry assault was originally planned for the 29th, but it was postponed for 2 days due to the weather. Finally, on July 1st, the British fired 500,000 more shells, as if the other, 1.7 million, that's just not enough. We got to have more. And they set off mines under the German defenses. There were actually, hang on just a second. I apologize. They had been tunneling under the German lines, and they put explosives at the ends of these tunnels, kind of like the Battle of the Crater in the Civil War. And they set these off, and these mines created huge craters, killed a lot of people, threw lots of dirt up in the air. In fact, if you watch that documentary I was talking about the film of the Battle of the Somme, they show this huge, huge, gigantic mound of earth that goes up like 200 or 300 feet in the air. Then the infantry went over the top, they attacked, and they followed behind what's called a creeping barrage, or sometimes a rolling barrage. And this is an interesting, this is a fairly new tactic that was developed. And it was kind of like an explosive shield for the infantry. What they would do is the artillery would fire shells just ahead of the advancing infantry. Now, that's pretty dangerous, though, because you don't want to do it too far back because you hit your own guys, right? But if you do it too far ahead of the infantry, then that gives the other side time to recover. Does that make sense? I don't know if I explained that clearly, Scott.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I don't know exactly what the risk factor is. I'm sure military historians have worked it out. I could see this being something that wouldn't have been imagined in 1914 when commanders were more risk adverse, but due to the massive death toll that's already taken place and seeing that we need new tactics, these old tactics only result in stalemate. We have to do something else to break the line. And we're going to see a lot of things here in the Battle of the Somme. I think this is really an evolutionary leap forward.
It really is. This one battle in some ways is kind of a microcosm of the war, because people always think of World War I as just a static war, nothing changed. And that's true in a positional sense on the Western Front. But as far as tactics and technology go, they were constantly tweaking and making adjustments and trying new stuff, as we're going to see here. I interrupted you. I'm sorry. Did you?
Yeah, well, we'll save it for later, because late summer, fall, the British do some things that are really different, but as we can see here by the strategy that you mentioned, the creeping barrages, they're already radically altering the formula.
Yeah, the idea is that the shells hit the German lines and then bang, right behind them is the infantry. They don't have time to recover. They don't have time to come running out of the trench, get the machine gun up in position and start firing.
So it works, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately for the British, in this case, it does not work all that well. It's interesting, too, because the battle begins on July 1st. Scott and I are actually recording this on July 2nd, 2020. So we're going to record yesterday, but I had to reschedule. So it's kind of funny. We're doing it almost on the anniversary of the first attack. All right. The attack was a disaster. I'll just say it straight out. I'm not going to mince words. The artillery barrage had not done much damage. As we saw, some of the shells were duds. A lot of them were. And most of the shells that did explode were shrapnel. And shrapnel is basically little fragments. The actual canister just kind of comes apart. And it's like almost like a shotgun shell or something. That's great if you're firing it on troops that are out in the open. But the Germans were not out in the open. They were in deep trenches and bunkers. And so it didn't really kill that many Germans. It also did not cut the barbed wire. A lot of the British officers told the men, oh, you're just going to walk across and you're just going to walk right there. You're not going to, they're not even going to be anybody alive. The barbed wire is going to be cut. All the Germans will be dead and it'll be just great. But none of that was true. Barbed wire and the trenches were still in good shape.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
So what about that unexploded ordnance, Scott?
Well, yeah, just to follow up what you said, a lot of shells didn't explode, and there's different estimates. Germans said that about 60% of the medium caliber shells and nearly every shrapnel shell didn't explode. The British say it was closer to 35%, but either way, the quality controls of the War Office had failed. And we'll have to mention that 3/4 of the shells have been made in America. So maybe this is a classic case of getting a hefty military contract and cheating the Home Office out. We don't exactly know why the shells failed. It could have been a shortage of labor and machinery. It could have been a rush order. Maybe the subcontractors were overworked. But because there were so many unexploded live shells, over the next century, farmers continually would find these as they're plowing up fields, and they called this the Iron Harvest in the region. So that's a legacy that lives on long after this battle is over.
Yeah, and one reason they didn't work very well is because whether they were made, some were made in Britain, some were made in America, but nobody had ever had to crank out this many shells in this short of time. And so they had to get all these new workers in, and the workers were rookies at it. They didn't really know what they were doing. So it was, it was kind of like having somebody who's never worked with electrical wire to come over and do your electrician work. You know, that would be, you wouldn't want that. So it's a lot of inexperience.
I've had some electricians like that.
Yeah. It's like, where did you study again? Yo, you didn't. Okay. But the British soldiers in this initial attack, they were carrying 60 pounds of equipment. So they were very tired very quickly. And keep in mind, this is in the heat of the summer. It's July 1st. That's the equipment slowed them down. The heat slowed them down. Plus, they were under orders to walk. So don't think of some gung-ho Rambo kind of charge across the no man's land. They were walking slowly. For one reason, to keep their formation, but also because, again, they thought, we don't need to run because the Germans are all going to be dead. The barbed wire is going to be cut. And as I said already, nobody, none of that was true. And the German machine guns just cut the attackers to pieces. Yeah.
Yeah. And just a little aside I want to mention on what they were carrying before we, I don't want to cut the momentum of the narrative too much of the battle, so I'll just mention this now. When we say that they're carrying 60 pounds, remember, listener, get out of your mind a modern-day Marine, for example, that weighs 180 or 200 pounds and is muscular and has been training for years and is well-fed. The average British soldier weighed about 130 pounds. James, for you as a Civil War reenactor, if you've ever seen original soldier suits, what stood out to me, and I don't know if this stood out to you, is how skinny everyone is when you look at their uniforms.
They're tiny. It's like my kid couldn't even put that on, you know?
So for an average day weekend warrior, I think it'd be pretty tough for most guys to be able to squeeze into one of those. That's a change that happens.
Right. They were short too. I mean, I think we talked a long time ago about the average soldier was like 5'5", 5'6" or something.
So this is the skinny guy in your gym class from high school, has 60 pounds to carry. So they're only weigh about twice as much of that. And that's not only what they're carrying. So, for example, the British 29th Division mandated that each infantryman carry rifle and equipment, 170 rounds of small arms ammunition, one iron ration and the rations for the day of the assault, two sandbags and belt, two Mills bombs or hand grenades, steel helmets, a gas helmet or gas mask in your satchel, water bottle and haversack on the back, first aid field dressing and identity disc. And the troops of the second, third waves had 120 rounds of ammunition. 40% of the soldiers on top of that had to carry shovels and 10% carried picks. That's just their personal kit. They also had to carry flares, wood pickets, sledgehammers. And that's part of the reason too, that they couldn't move faster than a slow walk. It is not a fast procession with all that on them.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the Germans, as I said, just cut them to pieces. They were well equipped, but they they didn't have bulletproof vests on, unfortunately for them. So I don't even know those were invented yet. But the fact of the matter is this is the bloodiest single day of the entire war. The British, in this one day, just on July 1st, they lost 60,000 casualties. And about almost 20,000 of those were dead. That's 60% of the attacking force. The Germans only lost 6,000. So it's another classic example of just how much the defense was favored in this war. If you attack, you pretty much are going to get wiped out, at least right now. Now, think about that, Scott. 60,000 casualties. That is the same number that – no, actually, that's 10,000 more than the total number of casualties at the Battle of Gettysburg, which was fought over 3 days, and that's both sides. So if you add up all the people – killed, wounded, missing, captured at Gettysburg for both sides over 3 days. It's not even as much as the British alone in one day. This is the bloodiest day in British military history. And that's saying a lot. The British have been in a lot of wars, but they never had as many people killed in one day as on this day, July 1st.
I mean, it's something that's easy to get lost into this in our discussion because we casually mention 50,000 here, 100,000 there, 200,000 Austro-Hungarians killed or captured or casualties, all these things. Just keep this signpost in your mind, listeners, of how huge this is, what James said, 10,000 more than the entire Battle of Gettysburg, the bloodiest day of fighting in the Civil War. And when we get to the end of this, we'll talk about how this war is earth-shattering in Europe. It wipes out a generation almost. It leads to all sorts of social unrest. Just keep little moments like this in your minds, and remember, it's multiplied by dozens and dozens of other such attacks and assaults that mow down people by the tens of thousands. So it's good to mention that from time to time because it can be easy to get lost in the numbers. I don't know if this is an apocryphal Stalin quote that, you know, a death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic.
Right. Yeah, I've heard that one. One other thing by means of comparison, just so I don't always go back to the Civil War. People are getting tired of hearing about that probably. But 20,000 dead. I heard in a couple places, I think Dan Carlin mentioned this, that in World War II, think of the D-Day invasion, June 6, 1944. It took 20 days for the British and Americans together to reach 20,000 killed. Wow. That's pretty amazing. When you think of how bloody D-Day was, it was nothing compared to this. All right. The British also didn't do a good job of coordinating their attacks. They attacked piecemeal. But in spite of that, they still captured two German-held villages, but they weren't able to hold on to them for long. And, you know, they didn't just give up. They didn't say, oh, crap, let's forget it. Let's go back to the old drawing board and figure out something else. They kept attacking. They stubbornly continued. And they did push the Germans back a little. They took about 20 square miles in the first 13 days of the battle. The French also made gains, breaking through the German lines and taking several villages, but they had to slow down, the French did, due to the slowness of the British advance. So that takes us up to the summer. Shall we go ahead and... We started in the summer. I don't want to imply that it wasn't summer. July is obviously summer, but let's go to the middle of the month. On July 14th, the British attacked at night toward the German positions at Longueval. They captured the German front line of trenches, but it was about as far as they got. And the Germans, we'll talk more about this later, but the Germans had developed, well, I already mentioned their trenches were very complex, but they had multiple lines, and they didn't even try that hard to hold the first line. That wasn't the point. The historian Peter Hart said the British had indeed succeeded in breaking into the German system, but not in breaking through it. So on July 22nd, another British attack failed. The Germans delivered devastating fire from machine guns and shell holes. So they're coming out of the trenches a little bit and going into shell holes. 5 days later, the British launched another invasion that took Delville Wood and Longueval. In August, you got to give these guys credit for persistence, right? They just keep trying and trying.
Yeah. Absolutely.
In August, General Grant would be proud. In August, French and British forces took additional German trenches. The German senior commander, General Falkenhayn, he ordered that every bit of territory must be regained. A German counterattack was ordered, but it failed. The So they, interesting on that, the Germans refused to practice anything like scorched earth or strategic retreat. They said, if you lose, you know, 10 feet, you got to take it back. And that was kind of costly. August 29th, the German government fired Erich von Falkenhayn. So Falkenhayn, their second senior commander, is out. And they replaced him with our old buddy Hindenburg. I mentioned this in the episode on Verdun too, but I think it bears repeating. Paul von Hindenburg becomes the senior commander, the chief of staff of the army. And of course, he brings along his right-hand man, Ludendorff, who really does most of the work. Ludendorff becomes quartermaster general of the German army. So Ludendorff is going to be doing most of the planning and executing of the actual attacks. So Hindenburg is almost a figurehead. He's kind of the, I don't know, the you think about the Wizard of Oz. Hindenburg is the man on the screen, right? The great, terrible Wizard of Oz. But Ludendorff is the man behind the curtain. Ludendorff orders the formation of stormtrooper units. And I believe we mentioned these earlier, Scott. These are these gung-ho German soldiers that are just going to run in with hand grenades and flamethrowers and just strike terror into the hearts of their enemies. Coming into August 31st, the Germans recaptured all the gains the Allies had made over the previous 2 weeks. So, again, it's just a seesaw battle back and forth. What was going on with the tactics, Scott?
Yeah, we mentioned this earlier. I want to get into this, and you can follow up, or if you want to mention it later, you can, James. But to the British credit, they're learning from their mistakes. This is the advantage of not being an empire that's ruled by a hereditary monarch that wants to take personal command of things and is firing military advisors. So this isn't Russia. This isn't Austro-Hungary. What the official British history says it like this. There's more to be learned from ill success, which is, after all, the true experience, than from victories, which are often attributable less to the excellence of the victor's plans than to the weakness or mistakes of the opponent. Well, there's some stiff upper lip wisdom right there. I don't know if that's right, a way to console them, but that is true. I mean, they are looking very clearly at what they can do and what tactics are failing and how they can finally puncture the line and make a breakthrough. So if there is a consolation, the British commanders did learn from their mistakes. What Haig did was he launched a sweeping change in tactics at every level. And he also promoted officers that could implement them. So we're going to see this into the fall, but one idea is to improve the concept of the creeping barrage. And James mentioned it. You start halfway across no man's land. You pulverize any Germans who crawled out there before dawn. And then you advance in a coordinated fashion. The goal is to do it at the rate of 100 yards every 4 minutes ahead of the infantry attack. So what the Royal Flying Corps did was they did image analysis, they developed photographs, and with this intelligence, their artillery does become more accurate. The Ministry of Munitions is revamped, the ordnance improves. So maybe the initial strategy of the creeping barrage, it's good in theory, but it was poorly executed in the beginning. So, but with this increased intelligence, with better munitions, maybe they can do it better. But it's not just the creeping barrage, it's also the infantry tactics. So men are ordered, you're not going to march line abreast like they did before, but make short rushes under covering fire. In the July 1st attack, the infantry was organized around the company, which included about 200 men. Later on, it's going to be organized on the platoon level, which is about 30 or 40 men. It'll be transformed into sections of interdependent and effective specialists. And
yeah, that gives you a lot more flexibility, I think.
Right, right. I mean, because the line is going to be moving and shifting anyway, so it's silly to imagine this long coordinated march. But the other thing, too, is even if you have a change in tactics, you need better training. And we see this happen with armies that are poorly trained, where people just desert or the line or the column falls apart in battle. And this is where the British military, historically and also in this war, excels with training. After July 1st, every battalion, division, and corps is required to deliver a post-battle report with recommendations. This eventually leads to the publication of new manuals that cover the practicalities of things like barbed wire, field works, knowing how to navigate uneven grounds, and avoiding enemy fields of fire. And then eventually all this intelligence is put into pamphlets, and then soldiers are required to read it, so they know what is expected of them to do. If your officer or your NCO is killed, then you know the philosophy to guide you on the next stage of battle, which is useful because people are separated from their company all the time when they're out there.
Yeah, they're in the process of becoming a more professional army. You know, in 1914, even 15, these were just a bunch of raw recruits. They were people that were came off of the farm or out of the shops or whatever. They weren't soldiers, but now they're becoming professional soldiers.
All right. So yeah. Does anything change up in the fall besides hopefully less miserable weather?
Actually, there's going to be a huge major change. Although September starts out pretty much the same, the British launched another attack at Delville Wood. You know, that could be a good drinking game. Every time I say another attack, there's going to be people on the floor. Anyway, but another attack. Anyway, so Delville Wood, which is on the front, the attack succeeded. At the end of the attack, the British Army was about 3 miles east of its original position. That's a lot for the Western Front.
For World War One, wow, that's like a continent in distance.
Yeah, no kidding.
Hey, everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
And then on September 15th, something really cool happens. For the first time ever, tanks are introduced into combat. The British used tanks. There was a new offensive against Fier and Courcelette. They had 49 total tanks. 13 of them were destroyed. Almost all the remaining 36 broke down at some point. They weren't very reliable mechanically. They were awkward. But nevertheless, General Haig was impressed with them, and he ordered 1,000 more. And that tanks, just like airplanes, they're going to be constantly tweaking with them and improving them and making them better. And by the end of the war, they're going to be pretty darn good. Right now, you know, it's the first wave. It's the first time they've ever been used. So you don't expect them to particularly work well. But in this attack, the British took part of the 3rd German line. So they're making progress. Now, on that day, the German Field Marshal Hindenburg proclaimed, "The main task of the armies is now to hold fast on all positions on the Western, Eastern, Italian, and Macedonian fronts, and to employ all other available forces against Romania." End quote. To quote, as Dan Carlin always says, Falkenhayn, the former senior commander, the chief of staff of the German army, he was demoted and he was sent to command German forces in Transylvania. So he's going to square off against the senior Romanian commander, who is Count Dracula.
Of course.
No, just kidding. But
he has plenty of sharpened pikes that he's going to impale people on.
That's yeah, vampire army. But actually, Falkenhayn is going to do a really good job in Transylvania against the Romanians, as we will see in a future episode. Now, on September 26th, the French and the British began another attack on Morval and Thiepval. I forgot to talk to my French fellow, so I'm winging it here, folks. Give me a break on these French pronunciations. In the early morning mist, prior to the attack, the Allies fired 400,000 shells. Oh, is that it? Just 400,000?
Oh, come on. Not even seven digits. Come on.
I know. Wimpy. And then one tank alone cleared out much of the German third line, inflicting many casualties. The Germans fell back to their 4th, 5th, and 6th trench lines. We're talking a lot of lines. These were the greatest British gains in the battle thus far. And in early October, Haig planned another new offensive. There we go again. Take a drink, audience. Thank you. And you're welcome. And this was supposed to capture 25 miles. That's very ambitious. That would be like in World War II saying we're going to go 100 miles or something.
Well, let's just capture Berlin that day, Haig. Let's just go for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, let's just – why limit yourself? But anyway, 25 miles is the goal. When the attack was launched, it was mostly a failure. As usual, the Germans saw the attack coming. The weather favored them, and their defense was dogged. In mid-October, from the 14th to the 18th, the French took the front German line near Belloy-en-Santerre, and a British attack failed at the same time. On November 5th, here it is again, Scott. Haig, guess
attack.
What? What did he do?
Ordered an attack.
Another attack. Attack, attack, attack. When in doubt. began on November 13th. Soldiers sank up to their waists in the mud. You know, this is the rainy season and the soil is so, I can't imagine that. It's like almost like quicksand. And as often, there was much uncut barbed wire. So again, this attack failed. That would be another drinking game, although I think if people literally stuck to that. Yeah, barbed wire wasn't cut. The attack failed. I think people are going to have health issues after they finish this episode if they do that. But officers were mowed down by machine guns. Rifles would not fire due to being clogged by mud. Still, the British took the town of Beaumont-Hamel. They also took Saint-Pierre-d'Avion. They took 5,000 German prisoners. Finally, so again, we're seeing very limited success, but not anywhere near what Haig planned. They didn't even come close to 25 miles. On November 17th, the first snow fell on the Somme battlefield. One day later, the British attacked again in the Battle of the Anchor, and that would be the last engagement of the Battle of the Somme. So they have to give it up on account of the weather. So that's it.
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of this battle? That there's an attack and attack, and there's movement. There's also the introduction of new weapons. There's tanks and other things. But, I mean, what actually happens? What's the result of all this?
Well, the most important result was the massive amount of casualties. Now, as we've said before, and we'll keep saying this, casualty figures are very uncertain. These are just estimates. And when you see, you know, you look one book and it'll say 800,000. You look at another book, it'll say 700,000 or 900,000. So we can't give a precise number. But historian Martin Gilbert estimates that about 146,000 Allied soldiers died and about 164,000 Germans died. If you add in the wounded, the captured, and the missing, the total is over 1 million casualties. So the Somme has the dubious honor of edging out Verdun, probably. Again, we're not sure. Verdun may have had 1 million, but I think it was probably a little less than 1 million. The Somme had more than 1 million. So the Somme gets to be the bloodiest battle of the entire war. Over 1 million casualties. That is just mind-boggling. So that's the human cost. Let's talk about what ground was gained or not gained. The Allies gained very little ground, very little. At the end of the battle, they had gained only 7 miles, and they were still 3 miles short of their goal from the first day of the battle.
Wow.
Let alone, forget about 25 miles. That's a joke. They only got 7, and it was over more than 4 months. So as I've mentioned, the Somme, along with Verdun and the Brusilov offensive, all of which are going on essentially the same time, they were among the bloodiest in world history up to that point.
So Germany has a triple frontier almost.
Yeah, that's the thing, is Germany's getting hammered because they were in all three of these battles. I mean, as we've seen, Verdun was entirely France versus Germany. The Somme is mainly Britain versus Germany. There were a few French, but mostly British. And the Brusilov offensive was Germany versus Russia, with a few Austrians thrown in just for good measure. Hey, somebody's got to surrender, right? you know, it's funny. My world history teacher in high school, he used to say that the Austrians marched into battle like this, and I would need a video camera, but basically they marched into battle with their hands above their head. I thought that was pretty funny. A little bit of an exaggeration, but not too much. All right, so as far as some more things to say about it, John Keegan, the great military historian, he, in his work on World War I, he says, "The Battle of the Somme was the greatest British tragedy of the 20th century." This is a quote. I should do like Dan Carlin does, right? "The Somme marked the end of an age of vital optimism in British life that has never been recovered." End quote. You know, he always like raises his voice. But anyway, so it becomes to the British just this epic, like legendary, larger than life episode in their history, kind of like the Alamo for Texans, you know, or Verdun for the French, you know, the Battle of Kosovo for the Serbs. This is like the worst thing that ever happened to Great Britain. General Haig claimed, now he claimed victory, of course. I mean, no commander is going to say, "Oh man, I really screwed up. Sorry guys." Not often anyway. General Haig or Marshall, actually, Marshall Haig claimed that by conducting the Battle of the Somme, he had accomplished three things. Number one, he relieved the pressure on the French at Verdun. Number two, he pinned the German army to the Western Front. And number three, he wore the German army out through constant fighting. In fact, he accomplished none of these three, although that may be a little unfair. He certainly did, to a certain extent, relieve pressure on the French. I mean, you can't deny that the Germans had to, they had a lot of soldiers pinned down at the Somme that weren't able to go help out at Verdun. But he certainly did not pin the German army to the Western Front. We've already seen that the Germans sent a lot of troops from the Western Front out to the Eastern Front to fight off the Russians. And he certainly didn't wear the German army out, although, you know, both sides took a major hit. One French general wrote that, quote, "This battle has always been a battle without an objective. There's no question of breaking through. And if a battle is not for breaking through, what is its purpose?" So Haig basically, Haig takes a lot of flack for this, not literally. He was way back from behind the front lines. It was his men that took the flack, but he takes a lot of criticism. And to this day, he's considered by many historians to be a butcher. He's kind of like Grant was accused of being in the last years of the American Civil War. Haig just sent wave after wave after wave after wave of attackers, as we've seen, to their deaths. And, you know, I think Haig at least deserves some of the criticism. He thought that the German army was beginning to crack, but was it? You know, what do you think about all this, Scott?
Yeah, I can see it both ways. And on the one hand, like you mentioned, it is a good narrative that almost nothing was gained if we look at the results. It's 7 miles. It cost hundreds of thousands of deaths, half a million casualties. Really, for what? If we're going to break through, what's the point of this? On the other hand, I think the optimistic take is the British were fighting an offensive battle in a war where offense was almost always suicide, fought to nearly even numbers, and they were fighting German positions, which we had mentioned in earlier episodes that the German trenches were much better developed than anything that the Allied powers had. And the movie 1917 shows us well, where when they're in the Allied trenches, they're mud and dirt, they're collapsing. But when you go up to the German trenches, they're concrete, they look professional, like they've been developed by construction workers almost.
Yeah, and they left behind a division of rats to defend them. Plus booby traps.
Right. I mean, and they have the planned retreat. It sounds like a medieval fortress, but it's a mobile medieval fortress that was built in the space of a year or two. And then you fall back into the keep. But the positive take on this is that they were fighting in a more difficult position, but they learned how to fight a large scale war. Their army was more professional when they emerged from the battle. We mentioned some of the different tactics. Tanks were critical. In this war, they're going to be integrated as part of an infantry. Later on in World War II, you have a own separate division. So the strategy of combined arms also evolves because they're still understanding how to use tanks. But the building blocks of Allied success in World War I is being laid at the Somme, if we're looking at the most optimistic light. Mm-hmm. It keeps the French from falling apart at Verdun. If they had been abandoned or left to themselves, then that could have tested the unity of the Entente. One German officer described the Battle of the Somme as the muddy grave of the German field army, that they suffered a blow here because there were so many experienced junior and non-commissioned officers who died. So we don't see it by the end of this battle, but this has effects later on where Germany is never at its strength and its fighting force. And these cracks grow and grow and grow until ultimately it all crumbles. So that's a different look at the Battle of the Somme.
Yeah, it's easy to sit back, you know, 100 years later and just heap the criticism upon General Haig or Marshal Haig. But I imagine I think he was doing the best he could. What was he going to do? Just sit there and, you know, try one attack and then, oh, sorry, it didn't work. We'll just let the Germans let them alone. No, I mean, their goal was to try to push the Germans out of France. And you don't push somebody out by just sitting there, you know? And the German army, we're going to see, is going to be on the defensive for quite some time. Not for the whole rest of the war, but they're really it's going to take them a long time to regroup and to launch any more offensive operations, as we will see.
Right. Well, that's what's happening in the Western Front. There was a lot that was happening in 1916. The Somme, Verdun, on the Eastern Front, Brusilov. In a previous episode, we went up north in the Naval War. But we haven't really been to the south in a while. We saw the Battle of Gallipoli in 1915, but there is a lot happening on the Southern Front in 1916 leading in 1917. Italy and Austria fighting each other. And then the Balkan Theater. James mentioned some about Romania, which we'll take a look at. And a whole lot happening in the Middle East. And if there's any legacy of World War One that still lives on today, I would argue that's the one that has lingered the longest. So we're going to get into all that and unpack everything that's happening on the Southern fronts in the next episode. All right, well, that is all I have to say for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Knowlton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, or I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Knowlton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.